Right now, the tariff for batteries being imported into the US is 7.5%. Based on statements made by Trump today, it looks like there will be a additional 25% tariff plus an extra 10% tariff on imports from China, get you up to around 40% tariff at this point. That really does change the dynamics quite significantly.
Do you think it's a fundamental thing? Like we will never get cell manufacturing right in Europe.
If you look at Eastern Europe right now, there's a lot of Asian players who are producing cells at significant volumes, be that, you know, Korean players or Chinese. So there is evidence that it definitely can be done within Europe.
How should we be thinking about EVs versus stationary?
I like to think of the ESS market as kind of the little sibling to the EV space, unfortunately. So, you know, when we think about kind of global battery demand this year, we're looking at around 1.3 terawatt hours. And the storage market represents about 15% market share. So we're expecting about 200 gigawatt hours this year across the globe. It is growing faster than anything else.
The global battery energy storage market is undergoing rapid transformation. Falling lithium prices, manufacturing differences, and potential tariffs all play a role. What's going on in the different markets, and what does the future of battery demand look like? In today's episode, Iola Hughes, Head of Research at RoMotion, joins Ed to discuss. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode, and leave us a rating wherever you listen. Let's jump in.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Today we're joined by Iola. Iola, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. And so as ever, we'd really like to kick off with who you are and RoMotion, who you work for. What do they do? Who are their typical customers?
Yeah, thanks, Ed. So yeah, my name's Iola Hughes. I'm head of research at a company called RoMotion. RoMotion was set up about 6 years ago to essentially give insights on the battery demand markets. So that started with really primarily the EV space, tracking EV sales on a monthly basis and building out outlooks for battery demand. We then really evolved our research into stationary storage as well and into other demand markets. So things like portables, 2 and 3 wheelers, even kind of aviation and marine and rail battery demand. We also do a lot on the kind of charging and infrastructure side, battery recycling, and a bit on EV motors and systems. So providing kind of market data and reports on those different markets. And we were recently acquired by Benchmark Mineral Intelligence, who are more focused on the upstream. Essentially now we're kind of providing that full value chain from mine through to battery application.
Okay, and this is going to be incredibly hard to stay on topic because the concept of like rail battery sounds incredibly exciting, and we should talk about that very briefly. What is going on in rail battery?
So there's a few people working on kind of fully electric solutions, but the main demand right now is more kind of hybrid solutions. So you're looking at basically kind of reducing some of that diesel usage right now by putting in battery solutions to kind of accompany that.
I love it. Okay. And this almost marks like a two-parter, this podcast episode, because we had Aaron Wade on a few weeks ago around lithium costs and changes in lithium supply chain. Did you get a chance to listen to Aaron's work?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was very interesting.
Very good. And more or less, are you kind of seeing the market in the same way? So if I kind of summarize a little bit of where Aaron was, he was kind of seeing battery cells in that sort of $60 per kilowatt hour type range.
Yeah, definitely. You know, over the last kind of 18 months, cell prices have dropped really dramatically, particularly in China. And that's primarily linked to where the lithium price is. So back in kind of the end of 2022, we saw lithium prices up at kind of $80,000 a ton. And now that's in September, it kind of got down to around $10,000. So that can be directly correlated with those prices that we're seeing. I'd say the kind of range of cell price that we're seeing on the low end for kind of tier three, essentially kind of low quality LFP cells, you could be looking as low as kind of $35 per kilowatt hour. You know, this is not really a sustainable price, and we're certainly hearing people talking about, you know, even selling at a negative margin. But I would say, yeah, more typically those LFP cells that we see as kind of good quality tier one would be in that range that Aaron spoke about.
When you say tier three, what does that mean? Like, surely a kilowatt hour is a kilowatt hour.
Yeah, so I mean, it really comes down to how established the player is, how many off-takers it has, and essentially kind of how trusted it is by the market. And that's really based on the quality of the cell that's being produced. So ultimately, not all cells are created equal. You'll have some which are higher quality or better made than others. And, you know, that's not necessarily the fundamental material that's going into it, although that could make an impact. You can have better grades of different battery materials, but also the actual kind of manufacturing process and the product that you get at the end might be of varying quality.
It might come through in like the ability to hit warranty, the number of cycles, that
exactly.
kind of
exactly,
performance
yeah.
detail. Okay. And RoMotion did a really interesting piece in the last week or two around the costs of manufacturing within China. And you were talking about an $80 per kilowatt hour number. What is in that $80 per kilowatt hour?
Yeah, so that was a really impressive stat. So something that we do at RoMotion is we track essentially grid scale projects around the world and various metrics around them. You know, we're not necessarily looking about at when the projects come online, but everything up until that point. So almost where Modo takes over. And in the Chinese market, we can essentially track equipment bidding, and that's the price that people have paid for the equipment. And then from that, we get our kind of average system price. So that, I think it was around $82 per kilowatt hour in the last quarter it came out at. You know, that's maybe reflective of some lower quality products. I think people like CATL, you may be looking at closer to the $100 per kilowatt hour mark, but that includes, you know, the cells, the pack, the casing, this kind of system. It also includes the BMS, the PCS, so battery management system and power conversion system, inverters, and also the installation. So it really is kind of the full package. You know, this system, someone buys it and it gets delivered to a site, it gets installed, and you know, there's going to have to be a bit more integration that takes place that the developer will usually do, but for pretty much all intents and purposes, that's the biggest part of the cost.
I mean, that's just like an absolutely crazy number, right? $82 per kilowatt hour installed, maybe excluding a little bit on, say, EPC or
land cost, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay.
But so in China, that would be very cheap as well.
Low anyway. Yeah. It's kind of a mind-blowing number. And maybe to kind of make it a bit more real, so what would that kind of same system cost in the US?
Yeah. So we use Tesla as a comparison point, and you know, their product is certainly a more premium one, but right now you'd be looking at around $250 per kilowatt hour for the equivalent system to be delivered, installed. And really that comes down to Tesla's supply chain right now, and also just the more expensive kind of labor costs associated with that. So, you know, right now, whereas in the Chinese market, you may have a player, an integrator who produces their own cells and then also does the integration themselves. When you're comparing that to a US player, they're going to be purchasing cells from China. So Tesla buy their cells from CATL, and then those will go to the US market, and then they'll do their pack assembly there and then their system assembly there. So just a lot more costs involved and yeah, extra steps. And then when you've got to think about tariffs, which maybe we can talk about in a bit more detail, that can also change things quite significantly.
And so when Tesla buys the cells from CATL, is it bringing in the cells from CATL or is it bringing in a kind of more comprehensive solution?
So they do cells. So historically, it would have been the packs as well. And that's what we see other players do. So if you think about some of the other big integrators, they won't be doing the packs themselves. Fluence traditionally has been buying in packs from CATL. However, a lot of these players are now moving over to introduce their own pack manufacturing as well. Part of the reason they're doing that, particularly in the US market, is to tap into part of the Inflation Reduction Act. So you can get a $10 per kilowatt hour tax credit, production tax credit, for pack manufacturing. So that's kind of an added bonus. And it also helps with meeting some kind of domestic content adders, which can bring an extra bonus to when you're building in North America.
Okay. And I think people have got a good idea of what a cell looks like. And I think people know what a 20-foot shipping container looks like. What is a pack?
So a pack would essentially kind of bring together a number of cells into a kind of bigger container in a way.
Like 5, 10,
yeah, exactly.
100.
Exactly. Yeah. So it would depend on the size of the cell. So historically when we were, you know, when this market was using maybe 100 to 200 amp hour cells, you would have had more cells within the pack. Now the market is at a point where typically you use kind of 314 amp hour or 280 moving to 314 amp hour. That's the kind of the single cell capacity. You'll now have less cells within a single pack and therefore less cells within the overall system as well, which helps drive down costs even further because ultimately you've got less packaging around kind of the energy dense part of your system.
Okay. And maybe just going back to the point we covered earlier around the import of cells from China into the US. So we had the Chinese figure at $82 per kilowatt hour and the US figure at $240 per kilowatt hour for essentially a similar thing. And then we're adding on top of that, we're going to be adding tariffs. And we're led to believe that 100% of the, a 100% tariff. So what does that do to that $240 number?
Yeah, so there's a number of ways to kind of think about it. So right now, the tariff for batteries being imported into the US is 7.5%. Under the current administration, the plan was for that to increase to 25% in 2026, essentially giving a bit of breathing room for US manufacturers to get going. Based on statements made by Trump today, it looks like there will be a additional 25% tariff plus an extra 10% tariff on imports from China, and that could be on top, and that's going to be on top of existing tariffs. So you'd be looking at that 7.5 plus 25 plus 10%, so get you up to around 40% tariff at this point. Because it's all based on top of existing tariffs, you could also see that increased further in 2026, up to closer to a 60% tariff. And you know, that really does change the dynamics quite significantly. However, I would say right now, you know, player like Tesla, when we looked at their kind of pricings that they're operating with, they are offering quite a significant, or they are basically benefiting from quite a significant margin. So whereas in China, we typically see players operating at, you know, close to zero or even negative margin, Tesla right now, their energy storage business, they're looking at around 30% margin. So how those costs are kind of swallowed over time may have to be factored into it as well. But ultimately, you know, if the price is more expensive, that's going to be passed on to the developer, to the kind of end consumer in that case.
Okay, so there's a little bit of flexibility in terms of how Tesla can price.
Yeah.
Do we see an element of sort of like buy it now and stockpile? Is that a sensible thing to do?
Absolutely. Like seeing that from, I'd say from all parts of the supply chain. So, you know, we're hearing it from as far kind of up as lithium carbonate. We're hearing there's been some kind of pre-buying, people kind of rushing to get it through. Similarly, from the kind of cell space, that's definitely been the sentiment. And then, yeah, even from the kind of system level as well, people are, you know, rushing to get through because there is this concern that the tariffs will come in very quickly. And, you know, this market right now is so reliant on LFP. And really, you don't have an alternative when it comes to where you can source LFP from. There are a few players with plans to build in North America. But all of those plans are, you know, a few years away. How successful they'll be is up for debate. So really, you're going to have to basically absorb that tariff in order to keep building.
Okay. And if you're thinking, what's LFP, do check out the session with Aaron. That will kind of talk you through NMC versus LFP. But I don't think we need to revisit that. I think we've got it covered. So where are my kind of stats going wrong? Because I've got this 42.5% import tariff on stationary storage, and I think is there like 100% import tariff that's been talked about?
Yeah,
where does that apply?
Yeah, so there's currently 100% on EVs, and you know, at the moment I'd say everything, you know, all the statements that have been made around tariffs, nothing is set in stone. And I think at various points in time, statements have been made, you know, we'll stick 100%, we'll stick a 200% tariff on these things. So I think there's a few mixed messages, but there was a statement just today that was, you know, day one in office, I'm going to introduce this 25% tariff on basically everyone, and then an extra 10% on China. Yeah. I think maybe almost a bigger concern from that statement was that they're introducing a 25% tariff on Canada and Mexico as well, which kind of goes against all the existing US, Mexico, Canada trade agreements. And, you know, we've seen a lot of build out or plans to build out within particularly Canada over the last few years based on an assumption that, you know, free trade will continue to exist and you'll be able to kind of benefit from the IRA or Inflation Reduction Act boom. So I think, you know, that's something which is causing maybe more panic in the market than the China element, because that was more expected, I'd say.
Okay. Is this good news? If I'm a US battery manufacturer, is this good news?
I would say probably not, because it's very difficult right now to source components from elsewhere, right? So, you know, even if you can become more competitive in the market, so you would, you know, ultimately be cheaper than a Chinese cell, if you're looking at your supply chain, you're still going to be very reliant on China. So a good example would be on the anode side. So the anode of the cell, graphite, synthetic graphite, which is predominantly used in LFP because it's better for longer cycle life compared to natural flake graphite. That's, you know, almost entirely reliant on the Chinese supply chain. So even, you know, if you can build in the US, you are still at a whim of the Chinese supply chain, at least for now. So I think it would be a concern kind of across the board. And, you know, you'd also be concerned about, you know, impact it could have on demand and then ultimately kind of consumers as well.
Well, that's just it, isn't it? It's kind of you're in competition all of the time with other forms of flexibility. So your gas-fired generation, if all of a sudden the total battery fleet adds an extra 25% to cost, then maybe fewer batteries and therefore higher cost to consumers.
Yeah, I think that the gas point is a really big one. I think I was in the US a few weeks ago and the number of people who were talking about, you know, the EPA rulings, the Environmental Protection Agency ratings and the rules that currently exist basically encourage kind of the switching off of gas peaker plants in favor of renewables and storage and other assets. Under every previous administration that's come in over the kind of last 20, 30 years, kind of day one, week one, they've rewritten those rules. And those rules reach across kind of vehicle emissions, but also those kind of greenhouse gas emissions as well. So if those rules change, it will ultimately lead to gas peaker plants staying on for longer and therefore, you know, negating some of the battery demand.
And maybe just making the conversation a little bit more around Trump and kind of how he will work with the Inflation Reduction Act. I think a lot of things that we've seen have been quite positive about almost like the momentum is there for a lot of domestic manufacturing, and a lot of this is happening in quite Republican states. What do you think that this is something that he will kind of move away from in principle, or do you think that he will kind of see some, or like he'll more see like an economic sense type argument and think, oh, okay, this is useful, we need this?
Yeah, so I mean, on the manufacturing side, the support definitely seems to be strong still. You know, if we think about states that have benefited from or are benefiting from the production tax credit at the moment, before the election it was like 57% Republican. Post-election it's 92% of the funding has gone into Republican states. So, you know, the beneficiaries of these are his voters. You know, they are going to be pushing for this. His fellow Republicans are also not going to want this removed, because ultimately it does feed into kind of a bipartisan goal of manufacturing in the US and bringing jobs to the US economy. So the general sentiment is that ruling will kind of stay in place. There are some concerns around the foreign entities of concern ruling within it and whether that would be a way to kind of tighten those rules. On the flip side, there's also been talk that, you know, maybe Trump will welcome Chinese players into the North American market, but on his terms, essentially kind of take the Chinese model that they had, you know, 20 or so years ago, where they invited US and European EV, sort of rather ICE manufacturers into the country, but they had to form joint ventures and partnerships. So having that kind of technology transfer into the US could certainly be a really positive thing. But, you know, in the immediate term, bigger tariffs are going to make it more difficult for people to build batteries. That's the key thing, I think.
Okay. And maybe from the US to Europe. So in terms of recent news, we have seen that Northvolt is struggling financially, Northvolt being a manufacturer of battery cells within Europe. What's the latest on Northvolt and why do you think it's kind of got to the position that it's currently in?
Yeah, so quite a sad week for European battery manufacturing. So yeah, Northvolt filed a bankruptcy in the US this week. And this really comes after almost 12 months of bad Northvolt news that started off with them kind of missing production targets last year. You know, I think they ended up producing about 60 megawatt hours last year from an original target of around a gigawatt hour. And then throughout the year, a series of things kind of continued to go wrong. So they lost their BMW contract, and BMW instead went for Samsung's SDI. They also shut down all of their kind of other ambitious plans. So Northvolt were extremely ambitious. They were planning to do cathode manufacturing. They were planning to do sodium ion. They had a system manufacturing facility planned, expansion in Germany, expansion in Canada. So essentially you're in a position now where all of that has been put on hold or cancelled essentially. And they're going to be focusing just trying to get the Sweden facility up and running. And, you know, that still seems to be the plan. The bankruptcy will kind of help them do that. But I think what it demonstrates more than anything is that how difficult it is to bring cell manufacturing online when you don't have maybe a technology partner.
Yeah.
And it's a different model to, you know, what we're seeing some players in the US do, for example, in that we see OEMs partnering with Asian cell manufacturers to form joint ventures and then build plants that way. Northvolt were very much doing this on their own. You know, they were using Chinese equipment. There seems to have been major issues around the Chinese equipment, whether that was how the equipment was operated, or maybe more personally around how strict regulation is within Europe compared to China. You know, environmental regulation, labor laws, any of these kind of restrictions, health and safety restrictions, are going to be much tighter. And ultimately, that will mean that, you know, the way that they've maybe worked in previously or elsewhere is maybe not a direct transfer to Europe. And it's fed into these issues, which is ultimately means that Northvolt has repeatedly missed their production targets and are now in this position where they're in, where, you know, ultimately they've run out of cash.
Do you think it's a fundamental thing? Like we will never get cell manufacturing right in Europe, and we will always, almost similar to how, say, solar works today, that we will kind of rely on China for a lot of that manufacturing.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll ever kind of get cell manufacturing working in Europe?
So, I mean, if you look at Eastern Europe right now, there's a lot of Asian players who are producing cells at significant volumes, be that, you know, Korean players or Chinese. So there is evidence that it definitely can be done within Europe. You know, you've got to hope that this was a sad story, that, and, you know, the Northvolt will still kind of pull through and still kind of meet those volumes. There's lots of other players with ambitious plans, maybe less ambitious plans, which is in their favour somewhat. You know, there's a degree of, did Northvolt just try to do too much? Should they have just been focusing on what they kind of set out to do rather than all of these different plans and ambitions?
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, people like Verkor, Morrow, ACC, they're all planning to produce cells and hopefully, you know, we'll get going in the next few years.
Okay. And you mentioned the sodium ion. So let's talk about it very, very briefly. Do you think sodium ion is the kind of critical storage technology of the future?
Probably not, no. So it's an interesting one. If we go back to kind of the end of 2022, when lithium prices were really high, everyone got super excited about sodium ion, because suddenly it was this low cost alternative. You could drop in this technology and just, you know, you're ready to go. This is great. You know, we're not going to be reliant on the lithium supply chain. The reality has kind of hit over the last 2 years, when lithium prices reached the levels where it is now. And, you know, if we look at on price point, they are actually reaching price parity now. So up until recently, sodium ion was more expensive at these low prices because of the anode. So the hard carbon that you use in sodium ion, that supply chain is not that well established and was ultimately leading to a higher sell price. We are seeing that sell price get close to parity, but the fundamental kind of technology behind it just can't compete with LFP right now. So, you know, your typical sodium ion cell that we're seeing come through, you're looking at lower energy density, cycle life maybe kind of 2,000 to 3,000 cycles, compared to one of these, you know, fully spec'd LFP cells that we're seeing now that 10,000, 15,000 cycles. And ultimately what that means is, you know, even if you're paying the upfront cost at a similar level, you know, you're going to have to replace that battery 3-4 times for the equivalent LFP, and the lifetime cost suddenly goes out the window. So sodium ion is kind of chasing down a moving target in LFP. On the flip side, though, I would say there are certain applications where sodium ion definitely does have a space. So if you're thinking about any kind of cold temperature environments or even hot temperature, it does really well in those places. The ability to fully discharge a sodium ion cell compared to an LFP cell where you can't do that is also a good benefit for cheaper transportation costs. And then certain applications, things like UPS, we're seeing quite a bit of interest for kind of high power operations. So, you know, there's niches that we are seeing evolve, but, you know, this flood to the market has certainly not happened yet, and, you know, would take significant developments on the technology piece to kind of become competitive.
just on the depth of discharge piece, right? So about LFP not being able to fully discharge. So maybe just to dig into that into a little bit more, what do you mean by that? But also, if from a like lifetime cost for LFP versus sodium ion, it's significantly cheaper, does it actually matter if you can't discharge it fully? Surely you just build a slightly bigger unit and get the same result.
Yeah, so I mean, on the first point around what I mean by the fully depth of discharge. So ultimately, you know, when you're transporting an LFP cell, you still have to leave some charge in it, which means there's higher kind of safety measures that have to be taken. So you can't get it to 0% in that sense, whereas sodium ion, you can get it all the way to 0%. On the kind of capacity front, that would definitely answer that question. One thing that has been raised to us around that has been the kind of land cost. You know, I'd say storage historically has always been like, you know, we can just have low energy density cells. We don't really care about land, but it's actually quite a sensitive market when it comes to building those operations. I'd say particularly in Europe more than anywhere else, where land is more expensive. And people are really liking these new 5 megawatt hour systems that we see on the market, for example, because it does bring down that land cost, or, you know, you can fit in more capacity for the equivalent land space. So that is a concern as well. But I think the biggest one is around the cycle life. So, you know, if you're looking at a kind of high spec LFP cell, those 10,000, 15,000 cycles, if you're discharging once a day, you could be looking kind of 15 to 20 year lifetime. For a sodium ion cell with 3,000 to 5,000 cycles, you're doing the same thing. You know, you could be looking at 3 to 4 years, and you'd have to replace that every 3 to 4 years. So it gets expensive quickly.
It's expensive quite quickly. Yeah. And maybe let's come back to the LFP number for warranted cycles. I've seen those same numbers around 15,000 cycles.
Yeah.
That's a world away from kind of where we were maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Are you seeing it coming through in warranties as well? Or is this just kind of PR marketing? Someone said 15,000, so the next person who's to say 16,000, actually none of it's true and it's all 10,000.
Yeah, I haven't seen any in warranties yet, if I'm honest. I think it's definitely more around the marketing side of things. A lot of these 15,000 cycle claims as well have been related to the 314 amp hour or even kind of the 500 amp hour cells, which should start to hit the market kind of next year. So it is possible that we would see that kind of from next year once these new cells and systems are launched. I think the CATL Tenor maybe does 12,000 is their warranty potentially.
Okay.
But you have to fact check me on that one.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Absolutely. Okay, good. So then going on from kind of stationary storage to EVs, how do these two markets compete? What's the relative size of them? And how should we be thinking about EVs versus stationary?
Yeah, so we like to think of the ESS market as kind of the little sibling to the EV space, unfortunately. So, you know, when we think about kind of global battery demand this year, we're looking at around 1.3 terawatt hours. And the storage market represents about 15% market share. So we're expecting about 200 gigawatt hours this year across the globe. What I would say, however, is this is the fastest growing market. So, you know, even if we go back to kind of 2020, the storage market accounted for about 6% of total battery demand. And now it's at that 15%. Point, so it is growing faster than anything else.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so the little sibling is growing up.
Yeah.
But okay, so and just in those numbers, 1.3 terawatt hours is the total storage demand, of which 200 gigawatt hours is going into stationary, 1.1 terawatt hours into EVs.
And bits of other things as well.
And other bits. If you all of a sudden have an extra 50 gigawatt hours worth of stationary storage demand, is there transferability in terms of being able to move things from the EV side into the storage side?
Yeah, I'd say we're already kind of seeing it in a way. So probably a good example within the US market. And in the US market, I would say that the storage market share is even more significant. So this year we're looking around 22% for storage demand compared to the EV space. LG, they were planning to bring LFP manufacturing to the US. They're planning to build a 16 gigawatt hour facility in Arizona. They put that facility on hold and everyone kind of panicked, like, you know, LFP's well, storage is booming, like, why are they doing this? It then kind of turned out, you know, they had a bit of an adjustment in strategy. The EV market's not doing that well, not growing at the rate that maybe was anticipated a few years ago. So what they're going to do is instead retool some lines at an existing facility to bring LFP online sooner. So it's definitely, you know, it's not necessarily an easy switch. You can't just turn a manufacturing line from NCM one day to LFP the next day. But, you know, if there's a well thought out process and the strategy is there, you can consider that and you can get manufacturing up and running for the different technology.
Okay. And in terms of just what you're describing there, so EVs not doing so well, I know we'll kind of like, we'll have a few people kind of on their keyboards. And so maybe let's just kind of explain that in terms of, you know, maybe what do you mean by EVs not doing so well?
Yeah, I mean, so when you look at it from a global perspective, I would say EVs are doing very well. So, you know, China this year is expected to grow at close to 40% growth, which is really impressive. And, you know, we're seeing consistently over the last few months, EV sales over 1 million units each month. You compare that to the US market and the European market, and maybe talk about the US market first. US market, we're looking at about 10% growth this year. No, pretty moderate. Things are kind of ticking along quite nicely. You currently have a consumer tax credit, which has had quite positive uptake. That looks likely to go in the coming months, but nothing too crazy to talk about. You know, the number of units we're seeing sold monthly in China is not near enough equivalent to what we see in the kind of full year in the US. Mm. So things are moving, but quite slowly. European market is a bit of a different story. So this year we're seeing negative growth in the EV side in Europe. And, you know, that's the first time since EV sales have really begun that we've seen negative growth happen.
What does negative growth mean?
So we're seeing a year-on-year decline of about 4%. And that ultimately comes down to Germany. So Germany is the largest auto market in Europe. Germany EV sales are down 20%. Compared to the same period last year, because they had a shock removal of their BEV subsidy, their battery electric vehicle subsidy, and that really had an immediate impact on that market. The UK is really the only kind of shining light when it comes to European growth this year. There's a quite strong zero emission vehicle mandate in place that requires 22% of vehicles to be zero emission this year, and we're seeing strong growth in the UK. But, you know, outside of the UK and a few other countries, it's generally not being good news this year in Europe. And ultimately what this kind of feeds into is a negative sentiment story, which then kind of gets carried away with itself. People see a headline of, you know, EV sales are down. They think, oh, the technology is not ready. Charging infrastructure can't be there yet. Maybe I won't buy an EV yet. And it kind of just starts this endless cycle. You know, even with the kind of Northvolt stuff, a lot of that initial rhetoric was almost tied to the EV demand is in decline and battery demand is falling off a cliff. But, you know, this is I'd say a short-term road bump. The long-term sentiment is still very much there. And, you know, policy support in the coming years for electrification is very strong.
Okay. And maybe let's kind of get the crystal ball out and go into the future, the 2030s, not so far away. Yep. What do you think that picture for EV demand, but also stationary storage demand looks like?
Yeah, so I didn't have the figure off the top of my head. I should have got that. But in terms of kind of growth rates, like, you know, we are expecting kind of sustained strong growth over the coming years. When we think about Europe, for example, as a kind of a good point, Europe has very strong like CO2 emission policies. So they have kind of a step change nature. So in 2025, an adjustment has to be made. And then in 2030, you're looking at a kind of 55% decline from 2021 levels. So you can kind of translate that into, you know, pretty ambitious amount of electrification in order to get there. The US also has strong kind of EPA standards that exist currently. They will likely get rewritten. The level to which they get rewritten is a big question. Mm. And then China, I'd say, you know, is on this pathway where electrification is very much the status quo now. You know, when we think about kind of the costing or the price of an EV versus an internal combustion engine, in China, it's now cheaper to buy an EV.
Yeah.
So, you know, why wouldn't you buy an EV in that sense? So, you know, we're seeing consistent months where EV penetration rate exceeds, and that momentum is going to carry on in the coming years. And then on the storage side, continued strong growth kind of across the board. When we think about where storage is being deployed right now, it really is a China story, a California story, and a Texas story, with a little sprinkling of the UK in there as well. And then when we think about the kind of global context of renewable build out, there is so much opportunity for kind of growth. I think a really interesting one at the moment we've been looking at is kind of the Middle East. We're seeing a lot of tenders come through there. We're even seeing players like Hythium announced that they're going to bring system manufacturing to the region. So yeah, big opportunities across the board, Africa, India, Australia, lots to look out for on the storage side.
I think on the storage side, and it actually links to your kind of ICE versus EV point, is when a technology gets good enough that it can beat the thing that it's trying to beat, it's very hard to put that away. It's very hard to hide that. You kind of, so when your ICE is kind of a certain price and your EV is more expensive, there's a subsidy thing that goes on. And as that subsidy comes in and out, the kind of sales look a bit bumpy up and down, whatever it might be. But as you say, as soon as it gets through that level, you kind of go, it's actually quite difficult to kind of, to stop this progress and to move back towards the other direction. I suppose you could go down the kind of tariff route if you wanted to, explicitly support ICE. But as you say, within China, if you have EVs that are cheaper, then of course, why would you make that move?
Exactly. The momentum is there, and you know, these technologies will continue to get better. I think that's always a good point to remember, is when we're thinking about kind of next generation alternative tech, not only are they going to be competing with the technology of today, they're going to be competing with the technology of 3 years' time, 5 years' time, which is going to continue to improve. And ultimately, you know, we've seen that cost curve decline of solar over the last few years. Batteries are following a very similar trajectory, and you know, the kind of solar and storage solution and what it offers now is really interesting and competitive. And it's also opening up, you know, new applications which maybe historically storage wasn't set to be in. So maybe a good one just to talk about is on the kind of duration side. So, you know, the historical cap for lithium-ion batteries was 4 hours. People would kind of throw that around as the limit, but we now see batteries being deployed at 10 hours, 8 hour systems. And historically that was always, you know, we'll need an alternative tech for this, we'll need a gas peaker for this. But suddenly batteries are kind of eroding or kind of widening the application use case. And that's going to continue to kind of evolve over time.
I mean, it's really difficult, right? Because you have, on one hand, the costs are declining, and on the other hand, the performance is getting better. And so it's almost like you have like two or three or four factors all at the same time making this thing a more attractive proposition. It means it's really hard to set policy around it. So when you look at like the UK, for example, the kind of the line in the sand that we have isn't 4 hours. We're more progressive than that. We've gone for six. But even that doesn't look very sensible, right? Because you can easily do lithium systems that go out to 8 or 10 hours. Yeah. It's very straightforward, and we see it in lots of other markets. So I think maybe where it all comes down to is maybe similar to the ICE versus EV thing, which is like, what's best for consumers? Find out what you need, open it up to the market, see what they say, see what comes in.
Yeah.
A really interesting place to have got to. I think I would like to kind of move on to just a little bit on just on those future techs that we might see. So do you see, or if you were to kind of pick out of all of the contenders who are also running alongside lithium, like, do you see any of those techs being sort of particularly noteworthy?
So in the Chinese market, I would say flow batteries are the ones which are having the most activity. So, you know, I think in our pipeline now, we're tracking about 15 gigawatt hours of planned flow battery projects, the majority of them being vanadium flow. The big barrier right now is that they are still more expensive. The majority of those projects are pilot projects. But, you know, the Chinese government and the support for these technologies does appear to be very strong. And ultimately, you know, the rest of the world will benefit from any advancements made there as it's kind of passed through. So, you know, that's an interesting one. And I think is also maybe, you know, pushing up kind of longer duration potential as well. A lot of the market mechanisms for long duration don't necessarily exist yet, but the potential is there. Other interesting ones, I mean, you know, we see the likes of kind of like iron air batteries and big ambitions from people like Form Energy on that front. What that materializes to, I think, is still a bit of a question mark, but you know, having a 100 hour duration battery is definitely a nice idea, but how that progresses is still a bit of a question.
It's really interesting. It's like the design of it, the concept of 100 hours is really easy to grasp.
Yeah.
But how does that then feed into a power market?
Exactly.
If it's going to go into a stationary market, and how valuable is that? Yeah. It's really, so when we talk about this, we find that kind of human behavior drives almost a daily cycle, plus the like shape of solar generation also drives a bit of a daily cycle. And so a 10 or a 12 hour system has a really kind of logical size to it. Then you go into 100 hours, it gets really interesting. And I know we had a form on the podcast, and we can put in the link in the show notes as well to that, to kind of talk about where they see form systems in the markets. And we've also had Vanadium Flow on as well. So we're going to be kind of stacking up this these show notes with extra links. But yeah, if you're interested in those things, then we kind of have we have particular episodes on them. Okay, so maybe on to my final two questions. The first one is there anything that you'd like to plug?
Nothing too much, but I guess just plug Remotion, come check us out. Yeah, happy to introduce us and have a chat about what we do.
Superb. And how would someone find Remotion?
You can go to our website, remotion.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, or the usual, Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, yeah, potentially. It's actually one post so far.
Yeah, exactly.
Very good. Okay, and then final question for me. Is there anything, so what is your contrarian view? Is there anything that you believe that the majority of the market doesn't?
Yeah, so we were talking about this before, around like, okay, what could be contrarian? And we don't know how contrarian this one is, but I think there's a lot of challenges to overcome before Second Life can really become a thing. So we did some economic analysis recently, given the kind of current sell prices compared to Second Life sell prices, and then thinking about it more on the kind of lifetime, similar to what I talked about for the sodium ion case earlier. And ultimately what it comes down to is it's going to be very, very difficult to make Second Life competitive, at least in the current market, and you would be better off kind of sending that to recycling or even discarding the battery altogether. So I'm not too optimistic on the Second Life front.
Okay, maybe some challenge. So I've talked to a few people on Second Life recently, and they would say, hold on a moment, don't do that. There's life in that battery yet.
Yeah.
We can take it from a variety of resources. We can bring that in. We can set it up so that we're kind of bringing together lots of cells from different places, put that together, run it at a slightly lower level, and hey, there's value there.
Yeah, so I think maybe in the context that I'm thinking about it, it's more for kind of larger scale applications. I think there's definitely an opportunity for taking something which is larger and then turning into something which is smaller. So for example, you take an old bus battery and then put that into a lawnmower, something like that. I could see as being a kind of good application. As soon as you in a scenario where you're trying to combine multiple EV packs, for example, you start to run into issues of inconsistencies between packs, inconsistencies between cells, you can have voltage issues, and it just requires a lot more work around, you know, getting a new BMS, doing the kind of full reintegration, which I think, yeah, will continue to be a challenge. There's also issues around kind of warranties and who's responsible for the kind of risk offtake. So yeah, maybe I was too bold in my statement. I don't hate Second Life or don't diss Second Life for certain applications, but I think it will struggle in the grid storage market.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Iola, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Transmission, a Modo Energy podcast. Transmission delivers conversations from industry leaders and experts exploring energy markets and the operations and technologies related to grid-scale battery energy storage. Check out our other episodes by searching Transmission wherever you get your podcasts. Check out the Energy Academy, our video crash course on how markets in Great Britain and ERCOT work, or head to modoenergy.com to see our written research. Thanks for listening.